The reading tonight is Psalm 137, and you can find it on page 627 in your church Bibles. By the rivers of Babylon, we sat and wept when we remembered Zion. There on the poplars we hung our harps, for there our captors asked us for songs. Our tormentors demanded songs of joy. They said, "Sing us one of the songs of Zion." How can we sing the songs of the Lord while in a foreign land? If I forget you, Jerusalem, may my right hand forget its skill. May my tongue cling to the roof of my mouth if I do not remember you, if I do not consider Jerusalem my highest joy. Remember, Lord, what the Edomites did on the day Jerusalem fell. Tear it down, they cried. Tear it down to its foundations. Daughter Babylon, doomed to destruction, happy is the one who repays you according to what you've done to us. Happy is the one who seizes your infants and dashes them against the rocks. This is the word of the Lord.
Thank you for reading, Lane. Well, I wonder what you made of that. Maybe if you're of a certain age, you started off with tapping of your foot as you remembered Boney M's song by the rivers of Babylon, that rather upbeat pop song. But I take it that none of us were singing along in our heads by the end. Not surprisingly, Boney M chose not to include verse 9 in their song for general release. And that last verse leaves modern readers like us asking, how can this possibly be in the Bible? And we'll seek to answer that a little later on. Now, I think that the pop song was popular because of the upbeat tune, but of course it does grate rather with the words of Psalm 137, even the first part, because they are an expression of intense grief. They remind me of a favourite song of mine, the Smiths song, Girlfriend in a Coma, which also had a similarly upbeat tune. And this mismatch, I think, is something that we as Christians feel today. Each Sunday we sing songs about God's greatness, about his glory and his majesty, his faithful love. And then it comes to Monday morning, we arrive at work or whatever we're doing, and it just feels distant, and frankly, it feels pretty unreal and detached from reality. In 21st century Britain, Christians are something of an oddity. I don't need to tell you that. Christian beliefs are held in contempt. Say that abortion is wrong, that gender matters, that only Jesus can save people, and people will stare at you like a cow staring at a gate. We are considered stupid, laughable, and out of touch, contemptible. And that can leave us feeling deeply discouraged. Now, the situation of the psalmist here was similar. The psalm appears in a series of praise psalms, which run right the way through from 135, right the way through to the end of the psalms. And last week left us saying over and over, "His love endures forever." We were praising the Lord for all of the good things that he has done for us and is doing for us. But then we hit Psalm 137, and the tone is rather different. It stands out, doesn't it? As if to admit that there are times and there are places when praise just feels emotionally impossible. how can Christians sing when the world mocks us, derides us, and thinks that we're frankly laughable? Well, that's what Psalm 137 is there to help us to do. But the first thing it encourages us to do is to help us to weep. Weep over God's church in exile. That's our first point from verses 1 to 4. Now, a little bit of background here. Two places are mentioned in the psalm. Zion or Jerusalem, they're the same entity, and Babylon. Now, in the Old Testament, Zion was the place that God chose to dwell. It was the place where the temple stood, the place where the priests and the prophets and the kings ministered. It's the place where Israel gathered together to worship the Lord. Our New Testaments teach us that Jesus fulfilled Zion in his ministry, that he is God come to dwell with us, that he is the temple, that he is the prophet, he is the priest, he is the ultimate king. But our New Testaments say more than this. They say that the church also is the place that God dwells by his Spirit. And so the church foreshadows a future heavenly Zion, a Zion that will one day come down from heaven to this earth when God comes to rule. And so in the Bible, Zion stands for God's rule or God's kingdom. On the other hand, Babylon stands for all that is opposed to God in the Bible, all that is opposed to his king, all that is opposed to his kingdom. Right from the Tower of Babel to the Babylonian Empire, right through to the Babylon that is destroyed in Revelation chapter 18. Babylon stands for, symbolizes the whole anti-God system of the world. And it is this great contrast between Zion and Babylon that led the great St. Augustine to write The City of God, which was the first philosophy of Christian history. In it, Augustine wrote, "Two cities have been formed by two loves, the earthly by the love of self, even to the contempt of God, the heavenly by the love of God, even to the contempt of self." Now, with this contrast in mind, the contrast between Zion and Babylon, let's now join the exiles sitting down by the rivers of Babylon, and what we find is that they are weeping. Now, it's nothing to do with the place per se. These rivers are pleasant streams and canals. They're planted with trees for shade. They're an altogether pleasant place to be. Think a pub garden. There you are sitting by that lovely stream as it goes past you, under the umbrella, sun shining. It's a nice place to be. But the faithful community of God, as they've gathered, are not relaxing. They're not enjoying the weather. They've gathered to mourn. As they sit by the rivers and streams of Babylon, streams of tears are flowing down their cheeks. Now, their meeting isn't an accident. They've met intentionally, and they've met to remember Zion. Now, is it just that they're homesick, they're patriots longing for the motherland? Well, I don't think so. I think it's about longing for the place where God chose to dwell. And the clue to that is in the language. They use the language of Zion here rather than simply Jerusalem. They're mourning the loss of the temple. They're mourning the loss of the assurance that came through the sacrificial system. They're mourning the loss of the seeming loss of the promises of God, which centered around the Messiah, the Davidic king. And we can imagine as they met together, and it probably wasn't a one-off thing, but they kept meeting time and time again, and they kept trying to sing the psalms to encourage them, So perhaps they sang or tried to sing Psalm 46. God is our refuge and strength and ever-present help in trouble. There is a river whose stream make glad the city of God, the holy place where the Most High dwells. Or Psalm 47, the psalm calling the nations to sing praises to God, for God is the King of all the earth. Or Psalm 48, great is the Lord and most worthy of praise in the city of our God, his holy mountain, beautiful in its loftiness. The joy of the whole earth is Mount Zion. But as they start to sing, their voices start to catch, and the volume reduces, audible sniffles can be heard, and tears are seen, as each one by one, is struck by the mismatch of what they're trying to sing and the reality. And so eventually the singing grinds to a halt. And then their captors, to add insult to injury, come along and taunt them. Why have you stopped singing, guys? Don't stop singing. We were enjoying that. What was that you were singing? Zion, the joy of the whole earth. I like that one the best. Sing us one of the songs of Zion, they say. It's a bit like at the cup final. You're 1-0 up, 10 minutes to go. And the leading team are singing, "We are the champions, no time for losers." And then the 89th minute comes with the equaliser. And then in the 90th minute, the winner. And you can imagine the opposing supporters at that point sort of cupping their ears, saying, what was it you were singing? Before starting to sing, "You're not singing anymore." And for the Israelites, this humiliation is acutely painful. And so as they recall all of this in verse 2, they remember that it was there on the poplar trees that we hung our harps. And what a weeping picture that is. Their praise is literally suspended there. Why? For, here's the explanation, verse 3, that there our captors asked for songs, and our tormentors demanded songs of joy. See, back in 586 BC, the Babylonians had invaded Jerusalem. They had destroyed the temple and all that went with it. They had killed their children and dragged the exiles off to Babylon. And so they ask in verse 4, how can we sing the songs of the Lord while we're in a foreign land? The problem isn't that they're in a foreign place, of course. They know that the Lord is the Lord of the whole earth. The problem is that Zion is in ruins. They feel that singing Psalm 46 or 47 or 48 or any of those psalms is just nonsense. Their songs say that Zion is glorious, but Zion is a mound of masonry at this point. And our songs say that the church is glorious, but the church looks small and feels insignificant. And we feel the mismatch between being in here and being out there, don't we, if we're honest? Well, that's why Psalm 137 is a real help for us. Now, most of us here, belong to this church, and we've got a huge amount to be thankful for. Probably our thinnest Sunday of the year with everyone away at church, but we're a good crowd of people generally. We've got a children's work, we've got a youth work, and by God's grace, we don't boast about that. Many churches don't have that. We come together and we sing God's praises Sunday by Sunday, but then we come to Wednesday or Thursday, and Sunday seems unreal. The realities of what we spoke about and sung about just seem distant. There we are in pushing the trolley around Asda, or driving to collect the kids, or we're in a meeting. God is great, God is glorious, God rules. Well, the world says that's completely unreal. The world couldn't give two hoots about the Father of our Lord Jesus Christ. To them, he is an utter irrelevance. The Church of Jesus Christ, what's that? It's another club, isn't it? See, the world out there, as we know, denies our God. We know he's king, but the world's indifference to that should grieve us. Grief, of course, is a mark that we belong to Zion and not to Babylon. Perhaps if we never grieve about that, perhaps we need to ask whether we belong to Zion. Or maybe we do, it's just that we're just enjoying the shade of Babylon a little bit too much. We're forgetting that there's this future heavenly Zion that we will one day see. Tim Keller says this, he says, whenever you see something good under attack, if you don't get angry about it, a right kind of anger, then you're not like God. You're not like Jesus. You don't love the good. See, our first response when we see these anti-God forces around us should be to weep. But then we need to learn how to sing the Lord's song in a foreign land. And verses 5 to 6 give us the answer to that. Secondly, we need to pledge loyalty to God's church that is in exile. I don't know if you noticed in verse 5, perhaps not as it was first read, it was a bit quick for us to take it all in, isn't it? But there's a shift in speaker. So who is speaking in verses 1 to 4? Well, it seems to be the community. It's a communal mourning, a communal lamenting. It's corporate grief. But in verse 5, notice the shift there. I wonder if you can see it. We suddenly hear an individual, there's a lone voice. If I forget you, Jerusalem, may my right hand forget its skill. May my tongue cling to the roof of my mouth. If I don't remember you, if I don't consider Jerusalem my highest joy. So an individual from within the community stands up, as it were, to lead the community in song and pledging loyalty and commitment. And this voice speaks by the Spirit of God. Ultimately, this is the Spirit of Christ teaching us how to sing when we're in exile. And he says, if I forget, if I don't remember, and verses 5 and 6 have been said to be the worst thing that could possibly happen to a musician, if I forget you, Jerusalem, may I forget how to play and lose the ability to sing. That's what he's saying, isn't it? May my right hand forget its skill. May my tongue cling to the roof of my mouth if I don't remember you. Christopher Ash, in his commentary, imagines a possible situation where there is a division between the older and the younger exiles. And the older exiles are kind of, they're the ones who are particularly hanging up their harps. They are the ones who are discouraged. They're the ones who are hopeless and feeling helpless and depressed. Whereas the younger exiles start to say, well, I'm not going to be just sort of carrying on meeting here forever, just sort of moping around and mourning and lamenting. I've got my life to live. I want to live it. I'm going to settle down in Babylon. I'm going to integrate. I'm going to get married. I'm going to have kids. You see, the temptation is one way or the other. It's to be disheartened or it is to be disloyal to the Lord. But then suddenly this voice pipes up. It invites them. It challenges them. And it invites and challenges every Christian who is tempted to downheartedness or to disloyalty today. The voice asks us, will I find my joys and priorities within Babylon, or will I consider Jerusalem, Zion, to be my highest joy? Will I live by faith or will I live by sight? Will I believe the promises of God and prioritize the church of Jesus Christ, or believe the lies of the world and prioritize something else? Will I be of Jerusalem, or will I slip back into Babylon? Because if Jerusalem is our highest joy, then we know that one day Jerusalem will come down from God, and Jesus will come too on his throne, and Jesus will wipe away every tear from our eyes, as we've been singing earlier, and he will say that he will be our God and we will be his people. And what we sing about on Sunday, we will see every day. And the mismatch between what we know and what we feel will end, and it will be wonderful. See, we're being invited here to join our spirits with the spirit of verses 5 and 6 and pledge our loyalty to the church of Jesus Christ. The question is, how can we do that? Well, only actually if we're confident that God will deal with our enemies. In other words, God will deal with all those who are opposed to Jesus Christ and his church. And that's our third point. Be confident. The enemies of God's church in exile will be removed. Now, for the third time in the psalm, we read the word remember. So the community remembered Zion in verse 1. The individual singer in verse 5 pledged to remember Jerusalem. But here the psalmist calls for God to remember the enemies of Zion. And by remember doesn't mean recall, it means to rise up to act and to crush their enemies. Now, I suspect there is something in us which wishes that the psalmist had stopped writing when he got to the end of verse 6. Because what he prays for, at first reading at least, seems cruel and barbaric. And especially when we come to verse 9, I mean, how can this be in our Bibles? We rightly deplore the murder of innocent children, but the psalmist appears to be celebrating it. Now, a superficial response to this says that this is just the words of men. It is a fierce reaction to the atrocities that they've observed, but not to be condoned. And especially for a New Testament Christian who is commanded to love their enemies. But if you think about it for a moment, if we say that the psalmist errs here, and we're not told that he does, then we are in great danger of crossing out not only this verse, but a whole load of other verses in the Psalms and the rest of the Old Testament and the rest of the New Testament, because we just have a distaste for it. And then you have to say, well, where do you actually stop? Well, you stop when you've got a Bible of your own making. So we cannot do that. Now, admittedly, this verse is hot. The question is it too hot to handle? And I think no, if we consider three things. Quite a bit to say about each of those three things. First, we need to remember that what the Israelites endured was atrocious. The Babylonians not only enslaved them, but they killed their women and their children. That's just what Babylon did in warfare. Why did they kill the children? Because they didn't want them to grow up and then to rebel. They were kind of wiping them out. It was the same strategy that Pharaoh had in the time of Moses. Wipe out the kids and then you wipe out any kind of future threat. And it was atrocious not only because of what Babylon did, but those who should have come to their aid, their blood relations, the Edomites, descended from Esau, well, they did absolutely nothing. Not only did they do nothing, they did worse than nothing. They aided and abetted them, and with apparent relish. "Tear it down," they said to the Babylonians. That's Jerusalem, that is. "Tear it down," they cried. "Tear it down, right to the foundations." And Lamentations and Ezekiel, and chiefly the book of Obadiah, detail how the Edomites not only cheered the opposition to Israel, but actually joined in the violence against Israel. So they entered into Jerusalem and seized its wealth. Those that fled, they captured, and the survivors, they handed over to Babylon, and all the while they boasted and they gloated over their misfortune. Now, whatever the source, disloyalty is always painful, and it is particularly painful, of course, when it comes from a source which is close to you. So how painful it was for Israel to be betrayed by their own brothers, so to speak. And how painful for our Lord Jesus, of course, to be betrayed by one of his own disciples, one of the 12. And so the psalmist says, "Remember, Lord." Now we struggle here, but notice what the psalmist doesn't do. He doesn't take things into his own hands. He asks for the Lord to deal with it. See, his belief in God's justice doesn't foster violence, but it actually limits it. The Yale theologian Miroslav Volf, who's a Croatian who witnessed the violence in the Balkans, makes just this point. To paraphrase him, he says this, that the only way to prevent people from picking up their swords is to believe in a God of justice. The practice of non-violence requires a belief in divine vengeance. Do you see what he's saying? That the lack of belief in a God of vengeance promotes violence, but believing in a God who executes justice limits violence. You don't need to take the sword into your own hand. You can leave vengeance to the Lord. "Vengeance is mine," says the Lord. And that's exactly what we see here. The impulse for revenge is curtailed because the psalmist can leave it in the hands of a just God. Secondly, we must remember that the psalmist isn't being creative here when he prays this. He prays for what God has promised. Look at verse 8. "Daughter Babylon, doomed to destruction, happy is the one who repays you according to what you have done to us." Of course, that last clause there tells us that it is an appeal for simple justice. Daughter Babylon has grown sleek and strong and powerful and wealthy by her threshing of the nations. And the psalmist is asking that she receive some of her own medicine. But the psalmist is confident that this will happen, that she will be brought to her knees. Look what he says, "Daughter Babylon, doomed to destruction." In other words, he prays what God has declared through many prophets, including Isaiah, declared through those prophets, that Babylon would be destroyed. She is doomed. So the psalmist isn't being creative here, but praying what God has revealed would happen. And of course, as I said, it did happen in 538 BC. The fifth year of the Medo-Persian ruler Cyrus, when he laid siege to Babylon. When he did that, what happened was that the Babylonian men, because they wanted to extend their provisions, they took their women, most of them, and they killed them, and they killed their own children as well. And if you want to see the Babylonian Empire today, you can go and see it. It is in room 55 of the British Museum. See, knowing that Babylon's going to be destroyed gave these older exiles hope, didn't it? They needn't wallow in depression because one day they can take their harps down off the poplar trees. And knowing that Babylon will become a cropper, well, it motivates the younger exiles to remain loyal rather than to assimilate into Babylon. But what about these final verses, which we find so difficult? Happy is the one who seizes your infants and dashes them against the rocks. I mean, can anything justify this being in our Bibles? Surely this is the words of fallen men and ruled out of court. Well, I think no. Thirdly, we need to remember that the psalmist is celebrating here the end of Babylon. From the narrow perspective, the slaughter of children is, of course, appalling. But seen from a broader perspective, not only does this mean justice is done, it also means that the world is rid of a great cruelty. Babylon threshed the nations. If the next generation of Babylonians grew up, then they would thresh the nations in the same way. But if Babylon are cut off, then the world becomes a safer and freer place. The psalmist is encouraging us to celebrate the broader perspective of God cutting off a scourge to the world. Let me just repeat a little bit of what I've said. The psalmist isn't calling us to be happy about and celebrate the destruction of innocent children. He's calling us to celebrate the broader perspective, to celebrate the destruction of evil. He's calling us to cultivate a hatred of evil, to hate what God hates, to hate what stands opposed to God. See, if we love God, then we will join the Lord in his hatreds. You see, Babylon, remember, stands for everything that is opposed to God. The anti-God structures and institutions and, yes, people who tempt us to hang up our hearts and tempt us to assimilate with the world. Well, I hope those 3 points have made this verse a little easier, at least. Do come and ask me afterwards. So I've not had time to answer all of the things I'd like to say here, or to answer the question about whether a Christian should pray this kind of prayer today. Maybe that's something we can talk about over coffee. But I hope that doesn't sort of derail us from the main aim of this psalm, which is to help us to sing as God's church here in exile. What's going to help us sing? What's going to help us to be loyal when we're held in contempt? Well, only when we remember the end of it all, when we're confident that in the end Babylon will fall. And of course, in Revelation 18, you want to perhaps read that later on, that's exactly what we see, the end of all of these things, and the people of God celebrating at the final doom of Babylon, when God judges her, removes every vestige of opposition, and opens the way for his people to live forever with him, and with him dwelling among them in the new heaven and new earth, without fear and without threat. So how do we respond as a church in exile? Well, Psalm 137 teaches us. First of all, we must learn to weep, and then we must learn to sing and to pledge our loyalty to Zion, making it our highest joy. And third, we need to learn to be confident that one day Babylon will fall and Zion will triumph to the glory of God. Amen.